This event recording is brought to you by the Department of War Studies at King's College London.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to this event organized by the Center for Grand Strategy. My name is Flavia Gasbarri. I am lecturer in War Studies here in the department and member of the Center for Grand Strategy. And tonight I have the pleasure to chair this event, to host here Professor Brendan Sims, who is a professor in History of European International Relations at the University of Cambridge, where he also directs the Forum on Geopolitics for the study of the world's most pressing current geopolitical questions within their historical context. And the Forum on Geopolitics is also the other half of the Engelsberg Applied History program, together with the Center for Grand Strategy here at King's. Professor Sims has extensively researched and published on German and British history and grand strategy, and his last effort is this book. Let me show to the public book that he's presenting tonight, a revelatory new biography on Adolf Hitler. We are also hosting tonight Dr. Dina Guseinova, who is assistant professor in international history at London School of Economics. Her research interests focus on modern European political, intellectual, cultural history of transitional periods, particularly the two world wars. And tonight, Dr. Guseinova will be the discussant for the talk. So thank you very much for coming. Looking forward for your talk. And the floor is yours. Thank you very much.
Thanks. So, to begin, here is a list of names. Those of you who haven't read the book or haven't read anything about the book are allowed to answer these questions, because those of you who have will know the answer. Just very quickly, just you see these names, which army, which theater of war, what years, who's the odd man out and why? And I'll give you the answers at the end, but I'd just be interested to see any guesses for those of you who haven't read the book. Anybody want to have a stab very quickly? No? Okay. This is not didactically very satisfactory. But anyway, just remember these questions. Do you want to? Yes.
I'll give it a shot. Is it the Austro-Hungarian?
That is, a lot of people say that. And I'm grateful to you for saying it. It's not, in fact, the Austro-Hungarians, but it's a good step. Yes?
Is it the American army?
I'll answer at the end. Good.
We have another attempt.
Oh, yes?
The Freikorps, perhaps?
The Freikorps?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another interesting option. We'll come back to it right at the end. It all will be revealed. But I think the range of answers indicates some of the possibilities. Okay, so why does Hitler need revisiting? Well, you can say history and individuals are always revisiting in the light of subsequent events and current preoccupations. So when I began writing this biography over 10 years ago, you had Bullock's biography in 1950, a first attempt at a synthesis after the Second World War, putting Hitler really in the context of kind of totalitarianism theory, if you like, but also stressing to a certain extent the sort of incoherence of his ideology. Then you had in the early 1970s Joachim Fest providing a mature and a literary approach in the light of the success of the German Federal Republic, asking the question, how could such a people as the Germans, civilized and advanced, succumb to Adolf Hitler. Then around the turn of the millennium, you had two volumes, Ian Kershaw's a monumental and classic biography, which incorporated insights from social history, advancing the concept of working towards the Führer. So it was a kind of mature approach in the light of how historiography had developed. But it seemed to me that post-2001, and particularly post-2008, there was a lot more that could be said about, in the light of the the crash, in the light of the globalization debate, in the light of the crisis of capitalism, and indeed also the resurgence of international anti-Semitism as a worldview, as an explanatory model. But even since I started work, there have been more biographies of Hitler. Volker Ulrich, publishing in Germany in 2013 and a couple of years later, focusing on his personality. Wolfram Putte, not really a biography, but looking at Hitler as a kind of a genius, an artistic genius. And then you had Peter Longerich's volume recently translated, which really put Hitler more in the center of the picture, emphasizing a little bit less, or less than Kershaw had done, the importance of structures. So, as you can see, and as you will already know, of course, there are many, many biographies, many approaches. So why do we need another one? Well, for the following reasons, I believe. And these are the central arguments of my book. First of all, that Hitler's main preoccupation from beginning to end was Anglo-America and capitalism, not the Soviet Union and Bolshevism. Secondly, that the principal driver of Hitler's anti-Semitism was anti-capitalism and not anti-communism. Thirdly, that we have, for entirely understandable reasons, been preoccupied more with Hitler's genocidal negative eugenics than with his regenerative positive eugenics. And I stress that's a term from the literature. It doesn't mean that I think, you know, positive eugenics is positive. That's not what it means. What it means is the way in which eugenics are used to elevate or to raise up the supposedly positive elements within a race. And negative eugenics, of course, is getting rid of those elements that are believed to be negative. And so we've emphasized the negative eugenics for very understandable reasons, because it led to genocide, and we've put a lot less emphasis on the positive eugenics. And as a result, fourthly, we've tended to overlook Hitler's strong sense of pessimism about the non-Jewish German folk. In other words, even when you take out the Jews and other groups that he deemed undesirable, he had a pretty ambivalent, at times negative view of the German people, which came really from his demographic anxieties around emigration, which I'm going to demonstrate, and his firm belief in the superiority of the Anglo-Saxons, Anglo-Saxon, by which he means the British and the North Americans. So I'm going to divide my remarks into three parts, which offer a series of insertions. So I'm not going to cover his entire biography, but a series of insertions to illustrate my general arguments. So first of all, I'm going to look at some length at the development of Hitler's thinking in the 1920s, because I think that's where the point at which it all comes together and from which everything flows. Then I'm going to look briefly at his policies in the 1930s, and then finally I'm going to look at these ideas in the light of what happens under the heading of war, living space, and genocide. So to begin with the emergence of Hitler's thinking in the 1920s. This, of course, and that's not controversial, was driven by the experience of defeat during the First World War. But that defeat, interpreted not primarily, although this was an important factor, in the light of Germany's supposed undermining from within, important though that was, but the fundamental experience of the First World War is defeat at the hands of the Western powers. Hitler spends most of this war fighting the British, or armies from the British Empire, one sort and another, and then towards the end, Americans, United States troops. And he takes from this, and I'll come back to the Americans in a minute, but he takes from this experience an acute sense of the power of the British. He refers repeatedly to the so-called toughness of the British, their ability to outlast, that they have the superior racial qualities, and so on. And he talks about the absolute enemies, Britain and America. And I want to focus on three consequences, and I'll illustrate this with quotations a little bit later on. I'm going to focus on three consequences of this here. First of all, a demographic argument around Anglo-American power and German racial weakness. Secondly, the development of an economic discourse around capitalism, which then powered his anti-Semitism. And thirdly, a resulting sense in the 1920s that Germany was being colonized by the powers which ran the world, which of course was the British Empire and increasingly the United States. So let me begin with the demographic threat posed by the Anglo-Saxon powers. And this is a phrase he uses himself, particularly later on, but then at this stage he refers to the British Empire and the United States. And the central point, and this won't surprise you, from his point of view, is that the British Empire and the United States have space. And if you have space, you can develop your racial equality, you can develop your economy, everything is basically at your service. And you can absorb not only surplus Anglo-Saxons from British Isles, but also excess populations from other parts of Europe, particularly Germans, who emigrate in their millions. That is the largest outflow. This is a fact. I mean, Hitler was not making this up. The largest outflow in the 19th century to the United States is from Germany. These emigrants are converted into Britons, and in particularly into Americans. So they represent a loss to the German Reich. They represent a gain to the British, and particularly to the United States. And in the First World War, this is Hitler's reading, they come back to attack the German Reich and ultimately to defeat it. How do we know this? Well, because he says so himself. And this is not in any other biography. In fact, it's not discussed really at all. But he comes back in the 1920s repeatedly to the moment, and I quote, in the midsummer of 1918, and I'm quoting here, when the first American soldiers appeared on the battlefields of France, well-grown men, men of our own blood, whom we had deported, direct quotation, for centuries. These lads, blonde and blue-eyed, who are they really? He asked on another occasion. Quote, they are all German farmers' sons. Now they are our enemies. And Hitler, and he repeats that on a number of occasions in different forms, and Hitler says that the Germans who had left were always, quote, the best, the most dynamic elements in society. That's, of course, a common trope in viewing emigration, that it's always those who have initiative and get-go. So there's been this constant bleeding of the most vital elements of the German people, lost to the Reich, added to the British Empire and the North Americans. And then I quote again, that all added up, he says in the late 1920s, and gave the new continent a particularly high value character. We encountered it in 1918 on the Western Front. Now, you might say, okay, Hitler says this, that he encountered these Americans. How do we know that happened? He says many things in Mein Kampf that are demonstrably untrue. So I went into the Bavarian War Archive, and indeed found this document written by Captain, I think, Wiedemann, as he was then, the brigade adjutant of the brigade of which his formation was a part. And it says simply, Private First Class, or Corporal, depending on how you read it, dropped off two American prisoners at brigade headquarters, 17th of July, 1918. So it happened. Now, we don't know whether these Americans were of German descent or not. I've tried to investigate that. But in a sense, that's not the point. The construction that he puts on it, on this encounter, which did actually happen, is critical for understanding his worldview, which I'll come back to in a minute, but you can already see where this is heading. So in Hitler's mind, the result of all this is a weakness and inferiority of the German people, because he does not regard the German people and the Aryan race as one, and or the Nordic race, he doesn't really say Aryans, he says Nordic, as one and the same. He says the German people are made up of many different racial strands, of whom the Nordic element, everything in inverted commas, please, of course, the Nordic element is only one strand, and maybe 10, 15%, then you've got Alpine elements, Slavs, etc., etc. And the Germans are, in his view, fragmented by class, by religion, by region, historically. And so racially, they've been torn apart. They've lacked space, as we've already discussed. And so the population has emigrated because it can't feed their population. And so we're in his view, a downward spiral, because you can't develop your race because you're impoverished. And so what emerges is a very, very skeptical view of the German people and a very exalted view, I hope you'll agree, of the Anglo-Saxons. And he doesn't merely say this in the 1920s, but he comes back to it repeatedly during the Second World War as well. You can ask me about that in the question session if you want. Let me now move to his engagement with world capitalism as he sees it. His first lecture, by the way, his first speech, was on emigration. The text of which hasn't survived, so all of this is from later speeches and articles. His second reported lecture in 1919 was on capitalism. And he was reported by one listener as having given, and I quote, a very good, clear, and spirited lecture on capitalism, during which he touched, indeed he had to touch, on the Jewish question. And this is something that Hitler also says on many occasions, but it's just in the discourse at the time. You cannot talk about capitalism without talking about Jews, and you cannot talk about Jews without talking about capitalism. His first recorded reference to Jews, thus, was clearly in the context of capitalism, not in the context of the Bolshevik Revolution. And I'm going to read out some more quotations, and they're all before he ever says anything about the Russian Revolution. So shortly after that, in a letter which is well known to the world, the so-called Gemlich letter, Hitler accused the Jews, quote, of engaging in the dance around the golden calf, worshipping, quote, the power and the majesty of money. He said that Britain and the United States had been jealous of the pre-1914 German Reich, had ganged up on her because they wanted to preserve their, quote, money world monopoly. That was the reason, Hitler claimed, to make war on us, quote, and then, quote, and now America, as, quote, a money country, it had to intervene in the war in order not to lose the money they had lost. They had lent, rather. And then later he says, we struggle against the Jew because he prevents the struggle against capitalism. So the origin of his anti-Semitism lies in his opposition to international capitalism particularly. He opposed not merely Jewish, but all international capital. I quote here, we fight against all large capital, whether German or Jewish. And he's described National Socialism as, quote, a new force whose goal can always only be anti-capitalism. He was, however, prepared, and this is an important caveat, he was prepared to make allowances for what he called national capitalism, by which he meant outfits like Krupps, you know, local large-scale manufacturers, which he thought were part, really, of the German presence in the world. And one of his great criticisms of international capitalism is that it tended to break up national economies and to attack national leaders within that economy in the interests of wider international capitalism. So all this leads, in Hitler's mind, to a sense of Germany being colonized. I'm just going to read out several quotations which will illustrate the point. But after, of course, the First World War, the Treaty of Versailles, Germany is partly occupied, it's subject to a reparations regime, its industry to a certain extent is subjected. And so he refers, here's a quote from January 1923, to Germany, quote, as a colony of international financial Jewry. 1921, he says, the Jews want to create a Jewish world state. This requires, quote, a great herd of denationalized colonial territories to exploit. He refers to Germany as a colony of the Entente. Later, he says, we're going to have the complete colonization of Germany, and so on and so forth. And as part of that discourse of colonization, he uses words like plantation, for instance. So he says, this is April 1923, the German Reich is, quote, merely a plantation under foreign control. Another quotation, he says, the state should not be the plantation of foreign capitalist interests. Or, most explicitly of all, and I quote, France rates Germany lower, and then there's an epithet about black people with an N, state. So that there's a sense in his mind that the natural racial hierarchy has been upended by the First World War, and white people, Germans, have been subjected. And then there's also discourse around slaves, which has many of the same themes, which I'm not going to read out because you can imagine what he might say. The gist of it is that the German people are slaves of the international world order, which is run by the Jews and by the Anglo-Saxon powers. So my point here is that, unlike what you might expect, Bolshevism and the Soviet Union was not the main threat in his mind. And that's not surprising, because Bolshevism had knocked Russia out of the First World War, and it also knocked, in some ways, Germany out of the First World War, although, of course, Germany had also been primarily defeated by the Western powers. So his fear of Bolshevism, which, of course, is very strong, is of a different order. He fears Bolshevism, and you have to sort of tighten your seatbelt a little bit here for a minute before I bring you down safely. But what he says is that it's not that capitalism and communism are two sides of the same coin as far as the Jews are concerned. What he's saying is that communism is definitely subordinate. Its function in the plutocratic system is to undermine national economies and make them ripe for takeover by the international capitalist system. So I'll give you a quote here. I quote, "The threatened Bolshevik flood is not so much to be feared as the result of Bolshevik victories on the battlefields, as rather as a result of a planned subversion of our own people, which would then deliver them up," quote, "into the hands of international high finance." And if you follow his logic, it's not hard to see what he means. What he's saying to German revolutionaries is, you made a revolution to get rid of capitalism, to free Germany and the world. And what did you get? You got Versailles and enslavement by the international capitalist powers. I'm not saying Hitler's right, of course not. What I'm saying, this is what he was trying to argue. And within his own reference system of reference, his argument had some coherence. So, all this, in Hitler's view, was the disease. What was the cure? So I turn briefly to Hitler's policy in the 1930s and 1940s. So his strategy in the 1930s was driven by two imperatives. One is well known, the quest for living space, and it's obvious to you now why you need living space, because you need living space to export your excess population. Two, and he works that out, of course, in Mein Kampf in the second book. But secondly, he also quests for Lebensstandard, living standards, which is perhaps less well known in this racial context. Because his argument is, until we get space, we need to raise our living standard, otherwise we will fall behind in the contest against the United States. If we succeed on the living standards front, emigration will become unnecessary. So he tries to match the American dream as part of a project of racial elevation, as he called it, rassische Hebung. So radios, strength through joy, holidays, Volkswagens, consumer goods, these are all part of raising the standard of the German people and making possible what he regards as racial improvement. And this, of course, is a long-term project whose ultimate completion will, at that time, be after his death. But simultaneously, of course, you need living space, which is why he has the active foreign policy leading to aggression. And his model here is not so much British India, but the white settler colonies, the dominions, and, of course, the United States. And you can see in the 1930s, intense interest. This is taken from his private library, captured in Berchtesgaden by American troops, brought to, I read it in Washington in the Library of Congress. It's sketches made for him of Washington, because he's thinking, you know, how am I going to design Berlin? He's looking at models like Paris, but particularly also Washington. Now, in 1937, however, Hitler comes to believe two things. First of all, that Britain is hostile to his European plans. And secondly, and even more importantly, I mean, that's pretty difficult that the British are opposed, but then even he becomes convinced that the Americans are opposed, that Roosevelt is hostile to him in every respect, and that Roosevelt has been captured, in his view, by the forces of international capitalism and world Jewry. And his evidence for this is Roosevelt's quarantine speech, famous speech in October 1937, where he frames Italy, Japan, and the German Reich as the dictatorial enemy. And at almost exactly the same time, he's also confronted by the failure of his living standards project. Because although there's a lot of flurry around cars and so on and so forth, in substantive terms, the German Reich in 1937 is not much richer relative to 1933 compared to North America and Britain. So what does this mean? Well, it affects the time dimension, which is a very important dimension in the book. It means that gradual transformation is no, in his mind, is no longer possible. We must move to rapid transformation. It means that you've got to manifest hostility to the outside world, means you're running out of time anyway. And this has grave and genocidal implications for his policy, because it means he has to step up a gear in foreign policy. He needs to seek living space in the East even sooner than he'd originally planned. So that leads you to expansion and war. But even more dramatically, the perceived lack of time means the end of the project of evolutionary racial transformation. So you now put positive eugenics, you now put much more emphasis on negative eugenics. So whereas in the early 1930s, he's talking about more gradual measures in relative terms to eliminate Jewish influence as he sees it, he now moves to a more brutal policy. One example would be the exclusion of Jewish lawyers, where in the early 30s he says, we simply won't license any new ones, there's no need to get rid of the existing ones. And that, of course, ultimately leads towards the Holocaust. So my last segment is war and genocide. The war that breaks out in 1939, of course, is started by Hitler, leads to the overrunning of Poland, then of France in 1940, Scandinavia and the Balkans in 1940-41. This war is initially, in his mind, at least, a distributional conflict. It is a war between what he defines as the haves, Habenden, and the have-nots, die Habenichtse. So Germany, the German Reich, Imperial Japan, Fascist Italy, they are the poor powers of the international system, and they're now asking for their, demanding their share. Just give you an example. I mean, it's a theme that runs right the way through his rhetoric, 39 to 1941. But here's from his New Year's speech, 1941. He says, quote, while the rest of the world is trying to take from the have-nots the little that they possess, we confront the world of owners with the determination to fight for the general rights of man and to secure their rights to the resources of the world. This struggle is not an attack on the rights of other peoples, but only against the arrogance and greed of a small capitalist ruling class. Now, obviously, that's sort of propaganda and rhetoric, but it's clear what he is saying, that Germany is basically part of the international working class in that sense, and they are staking their claim against international capitalism. With the Holocaust, we then come to the core of Hitler's strategy, in World War II, which is the mass murder of the Jews to punish then the United States and the British Empire. His original hope was, by threatening the Jews, keeping them as hostages, he would deter the United States. Once that's no longer the case, from late 1941 onwards, you move to the mass murder of the Western and Central European Jews. Of course, those in the Soviet Union have already been murdered largely by the Einsatzgruppen. He's also seeking, of course, living space in the East through Operation Barbarossa to balance the United States and the British Empire. The point is he attacks the Soviet Union not because he's particularly hostile to Stalin, of course he's hostile to Stalin, but he's going there to take the territory. The Soviet Union is not the primary target of either the Holocaust or Operation Barbarossa. It is the theater, but it is not the primary target. The primary target are the Anglo-Saxon powers and what he regards as world Jewry. And the colonization of the East is intended to reverse the demographic drain. So in 1941, 1942, he repeatedly compares the Ukraine to the American West. He predicts that, quote, 2 or 3 million men will settle there from, quote, Germany, Scandinavia, the Western European countries, and America. So to reverse the drain, to bring back the German Americans. If you don't succeed, your fate, basically, is that of Native Americans. Why do I say that? Here's a quote from November 1944. He says, the world knows no empty spaces. Peoples who are numerically or biologically too weak to maintain their living space can at best expect to be given a reservation. So these words are chosen with care. In his mind, unless the German people get their living space, they will end up like the Native Americans, who he refers to on earlier occasions as being the victims of the Anglo-Saxons. The Germans will meet the same fate. But of course, as we know, although Hitler was desperately trying to avoid what he regarded as the mistakes of the First World War, that is to say, taking on the Americans who have all these German immigrants, taking on the British Empire, and so on, history repeats itself. He ends up at war with the United States in December 1941, a war he declares. We can discuss that in detail later on, essentially because he believes himself already at war with the United States through the hostility of President Roosevelt. He is intensely conscious that he's fighting emigrants. In his two New Year speeches in 1942, 1943, he refers to the fact that we are now fighting German emigrants in the United States. Indeed, the SS is tasked with seeking among American prisoners the so-called lost, das verlorene Deutschtum, the lost German elements. And then in July 1944, he makes a truly incredible speech to the leaders of German industry. And there are many reasons to be depressed in July 1944, because, of course, the Allies have landed in Normandy. The Soviet Union is on the march on the against Army Group Center. Anglo-American bomber fleets are leveling the Reich in terms of population center, pulverizing the industry. And Hitler's talking to the leaders of German industry, and he says, I know you're all very worried about German engineers who are working for the Americans. And then he says, but don't worry, I have German engineers as well. Which is a very strange thing to say, unless, which is also the case, you are conscious of the fact that there are so many Germans in the American factories constructing weapons for the Americans, which was true. I could give you several examples. But what happens, of course, in the war is that German industry is destroyed by the US Air Force, commanded by General Spaatz, S-P-A-A-T-Z. He added in 1937 the extra A to his name. His real name was Spaatz. So he added an A to suggest he was Dutch, but he was in fact Pennsylvania Dutch, which means German. And of course, the Allied armies were under the supreme command of General Eisenhower, who was the descendant of Rhenish Mennonites who had left Germany hundreds of years before. And so you can all answer these questions. Of course, they are all, as Marianne said, American generals. You're absolutely right. And the exception is this chap. He's Canadian. So, and that's simply a snapshot, simply a random snapshot of American generals in Northwestern Europe, 1944-1945. So, one last thing on anti-Semitism and anti-capitalism. This is next to the racial theme I've just elaborated. This remains entirely consistent, a theme, in his rhetoric and thinking from 1919, I've read several instances of that, right the way through to 1945. In April 1945, when he was surrounded by the Red Army in Berlin, in his last will and testament, he makes no direct reference to either communism or the Soviet Union, but inveighs instead against the real villains, and I quote, international Jewry, the ruling political clique in England, the international conspiracy of money and finance, end of quotation. So, as at the beginning, so at the end. Thank you for your attention.
That concludes this event recording. For more news and information on upcoming events, please visit our website at kcl.ac.uk/warstudies.